That is also just the basic pattern, right? According to Vishwanath Chakravarti and Madhurya Kadambini, right? You get Utsahanmayi and then you get Kanatarala. So I guess it just happens to everybody. You get really excited, you get that really toxic certainty, and then you realize that you're not going to go back to Godhead, so to speak, in 4 weeks. And then you wonder about, maybe it'll be 4 years. And then, you know, 4 years later, you're faced with that dilemma of how much work do you actually want to put into this? But that's actually the fun part, really, is the fun part is, it's kind of like self-discovery, isn't it? Like, I kind of feel like I'm pulling away more and more layers of myself or layers of my mind or something, so that it's just kind of seeing more and more how lazy I am, and then I don't want to work for this. But then you wind up thinking, no, that, you know, this ideal of Krishna, it's really beautiful. It's really worth it. Let's not give up. You know, let's hang on to whatever bit of it we can hang on to and keep it. That's kind of the fun part, seeing how I survive. It's almost like a video game, like you have to get through some kind of maze or something and survive the bombs. And you see how you get through them and you get out the other side. It's kind of exciting. And then sometimes you don't, you get bombed and you sink into the depths for a while. That's also exciting. I mean, I don't know. There's two ways to look at life. One is that it's hell and one is that it's beautiful. So I think maybe, you know, it's just more healthier to look at it like it's beautiful, even the bombs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, we will be sitting at the table with artist, author, Vaishnav scholar, and astrologer, Braj Kishore. Braj Kishore joined ISKCON in 1990 and pursued formal studies at the Vrindavan Institute for Higher Education for 3 years. He later spent 6 years with the Krishna punk band 108, integrating devotional themes into alternative music culture. Married in 1997, he's a father of three. Professionally, he has worked in both software development and language teaching before transitioning into the field of Vedic astrology, where he now focuses his efforts. He has translated the Bhagavad Gita and 4 cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and is currently working on the 5th canto of the Bhagavatam, as well as the Yoga Sutras. In today's conversation with Braj Kishore, we explore his life, his journey, especially as depicted in his memoir, Train Wrecks and Transcendence, talking about relationships, talking about initial enthusiasm, spiritual life, and how then to be grounded and land into reality, how to become responsible as human beings in this world, how to learn and appreciate our relationships with friends, couple, parents, guru, God, the importance of how the arc of progress many times takes us from an initial rigidity to an attraction with depth and esoteric content, and eventually we may end up doing full circle and going back to simplicity, one that integrates complexity, and where we can find the deepest of the deepest, even in the so-called ordinary. So among these and many other topics, we have shared today with Braj Kishore. Welcome to the table. This is the Free Radical Podcast. And to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell, and if you feel nourished by the conversation, like it, share it, and drop your thoughts in the comment section as well to keep the conversation perpetually ongoing. Without further ado, dear friends, brothers, sisters, family, here is Braj Kishore. Braj Kishore Prabhu, thanks so much for coming. Welcome to the Free Radical Podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. I like to ask my guests generally, What does the word free radical evoke in you? For me, free radical means going to the radix, to the root of things, in as freeing a way as possible. But tell me, what does it evoke for you?
I think that's the real meaning. But nonetheless, the initial thing that comes to my mind is like some kind of health food or something. Okay. I don't know, like detox, deoxygenization or something.
Okay, get that's rid of the great. That's why I ask every time my guests, because they will always come up with something completely new and unexpected. So I will add that to my list of.
Okay.
Yeah. Those people with the word radical, they got a little scared, right? So if I say, no, it has to do with health food, it can kind of balance the equation.
Yeah.
Interestingly. So anyhow, going through your, I don't know, your life, your bio, your life story, there's a wide range of, I will say, roles and experiences. You're an author, musician, software developer, father, astrologer, and whatnot. So let's see how much we can cover. But I was interested in going through a little bit through that journey. And
sure.
Let's begin at the end of the list, if you agree with astrology.
Sure.
And in your work with Vedic astrology, I'm curious, how do you understand the relationship between, and probably this question has been asked for you 108,000 times, but how do you understand the relationship between astrology and free will, especially considering that some people, including within Bhakti circles, may lean toward a kind of determinism in terms of astrology, as if everything were already fixed. So where does personal responsibility come into play?
As far as I understand it, your free will is what causes your destiny. So it's like you choose to take some kind of an action, and then there's some kind of a result from that. And then that result is not something that you can avoid. It's not like you have a choice. If I push, I don't know, if I push a boulder down a hill, that's my choice. That's my free choice. But after that, it's rolling, right?
Yeah. So, and then your choice is how you react to the unavoidable result of your previous choice.
Yeah. And kind of, I feel like people have more and less freedom of choice, you know, they, depending on how free they are from that reflexive reaction to what's going on around them, how much kind of detachment and knowledge they have gives them the ability to not just react to things in the same pattern.
Yeah. Yeah, react or overreact, yeah, or underreact.
Yeah. Yeah.
So will you say that astrology is, I don't know, let's say you have your chart and some quote-unquote predictions are there, it's more kind of a depiction, portrayal of a karmic momentum that was created by previous actions that tends to go in a certain direction, but that doesn't mean that it's completely predetermined, and still you have the choice to, how do you choose to react to that, to respond to that? At least in principle.
Yeah. What I think is, in Yoga Sutra, Patanjali said that you have all these infinite samskaras, but you get a certain ones activated per lifetime, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think actually what the planetary configurations actually describe is the activated samskaras for that lifetime. So that's what it's talking about. It's talking about what kind of impetuses are you going to feel, what kind of pushes, you know, what kind of motivations, what kind of emotional things are going to be happening, driving your actions. And of course, you might have more or less freedom to interact with those depending on how detached and how much knowledge you have.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it does show, basically it's showing the karma, because the samskara is the karmashaya, it's the holder of the karma. So by showing the samskaras, it's showing the karma, and then by showing the karma, it's showing the pala, which is what happens to you. I don't know. I don't really think determinism is wrong, but you can't take free will out of the picture, otherwise it's meaningless. Yeah. Like, free will has to be the origin of it.
Yeah, because as I like to say, if we take free will out of the picture, at least from our Gaudiya perspective, cartridge to our agency is one of the intrinsic elements of the soul. So you take that out and Atman stops existing, which is a contradiction of terms, basically.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes ever, though I cannot tell you where it's from. I mean, I believe it's from one of the Samhitas, like one of the original four Vedas, but one of my favorite quotes is, if there's no free will, the Vedas are speaking. And they say, if there's no free will, then why do we even exist? Why do the Vedas exist? We exist because mm-hmm. you have a choice about what to do, and we're trying to inform you about what the best choice is.
Mm. Thank you. Okay, so we can continue in the astrological trajectory, but again, there are many facets to the jewel that you are. So I'd like to move for a moment from your work in astrology to you're also an author. So I remember personally, I came across you, your work many years ago through your website, The Enquirer. And what stood out to me was, yeah, not only the range of topics, the depth, the originality of the writing, but also the willingness to address topics that were, and in many cases still are, considered taboo within Gaudiya Vaishnava circles, questions about sex and gender and the position of a woman, even some esoteric aspects of the tradition. So looking back and considering that many of those articles were written decades ago, do you feel that the taboos within the Vaishnava society have remained the same, or have new ones emerged? Do you have more advanced taboos, more refined taboos? Are we making some progress? Or in other words, what do you think we need to be speaking about today in order to remain relevant, honest, and deep as Gaudiya Vaishnava, not only relevant to the world, but relevant to ourselves as sadhakas, so the tradition remains something living, relatable?
I really don't feel qualified to answer the question, because I think that's everybody else's business, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I know for myself what I need to ask myself, and I know for myself what I need to think about, what issues I need to face and not be scared of. But I don't know for somebody else. It pains me in a sadly comical way to see how things really haven't really changed in terms mm-hmm. of what's still wrong with the organized Western movements of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. It's still like, come on, are you serious? You're still dealing with these things that you should have figured out 40 years ago? I mean, it's not my ballpark anymore. You know, I gave up on trying to wrestle with that. I just wish the best for everybody and hope that they've, you know, fix their leaks.
Mm-hmm. And if I may ask on a personal level, what's relevant for you in your journey? Again.
I really enjoy, and I feel it's very important to me, to find the simplest truths that actually work. You know, the simplest things that are actually real. Like, I'm not really that enthusiastic for very esoteric discussions or anything anymore. You know, to me,
you are in the past, I will say.
Sure, I love that stuff too.
And I'm not criticizing that. It's an interesting arc in your journey. Just I'm appreciating that.
It's one thing I really like with the story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is how he went to Radhakund and he talked on Ishopanishad.
Yeah.
Like that. Like, I think that's really brilliant.
I can definitely identify with that as well. And I've heard from Srila Bhaktiraksaka Siddharthadev Goswami Maharaj, which is one of my main inspiration, that he will speak about very basic topics in the deepest possible way.
Right. That's what I like. That's what's
really called in that direction, rather than jumping into the highest possible thing and not knowing what to do with that.
Yeah. To me, like, I'll understand the highest possible things after I figure out, like, the highest possible things are not unrelated to the most basic things that are right in front of my face. Mm-hmm. So I really want to actually, I'm really enjoying those moments where you just kind of realize, you know, I don't know, what the tree in front of you really is, you know, or like what your pet bunny really is, you know.
Get to see the tree as Mahaprabhu saw it and inspire him to say taror api sahishnuna. Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for
sharing. that's one thing. I mean, there's plenty of other things that I have to work on, like
but
myself.
I will not wanting to universalize your own journey, but I personally feel, and I resonate with that myself, and I will say that at least in general, there is a big place for that in the journey of many. Like, okay, maybe more basic, more introductory, then more esoteric and deep, and maybe like a full circle returning to the basic, but integrating the depth and the esoteric and rediscovering the highest in the quote-unquote lowest. I it feels to me like a very natural trajectory of progress and integration, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And of course, apart, you wrote many articles, but also you have written several books, some of which I've read, especially your renderings, some of your renderings of the early cantos of the Bhagavatam, and your simple Gita, which I really appreciate. Again, speaking about keeping things simple, I especially appreciated there the dialogical style, the in-between questions and reflections, very much in the spirit of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's writing. So thanks for that contribution.
Thank you.
That said, you are currently, from what you told me, you're working on the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam now.
Yeah, it's almost done.
Great. So includes that canto, that volume in particular, includes, among other things, the description of the so-called hellish planets. So many readers struggle with these passages, right? Especially when trying to reconcile those sections with a theology centered on divine love and a God that is described as Karuna Sindhu, an ocean of mercy. And they struggle how to keep all these things together. In my forthcoming book that I'm writing, it's on unconditional love and what's the implications of that, and theodicy is there. So I engage with this section, the hellish planets, to some length, particularly those sections where the punishments described, at least to me and to others, seem a little strikingly disproportionate sometimes to the actions involved. So for me, sometimes, and others raise the question of whether such depictions are meant to be taken literally or whether they might function as, I don't know, a pedagogical tool or rhetorical device, perhaps even a strong exaggeration intended to prevent some people from certain behaviors. So anyhow, how do you personally approach this description as you have been writing about them? Do you understand this is
really
literal reality?
Yeah.
Sorry?
I really enjoyed that chapter, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The chapter on the health. What is it? One? I think it's one chapter at the end, right? Maybe just, yeah, it's just one. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. And I felt like it made perfect sense, to be honest. Maybe I'm just a very punk, like, you know, I'm okay with like extreme punishments.
I was going to say, you have a background of heavy metal, black metal, maybe even. So I don't know how much that's filtering.
Yeah. It made a lot of sense to me. Actually, maybe I'm looking forward to publishing the chapter, because you have to set it in the whole context of, first of all, even what are the hells? They're not even physically located in the physical universe.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the questions of Parikshit. Where are they? And the answer is they're between the waters and the three worlds. They're not even like a physical reality place, according to Shuka. You know, they're... It's like what happens to you in dreams in between the days when you're awake. And actually, I found that I felt there's an immense sense of justice to the punishments. And I felt that the punishments made sense. And you could see how they're helpful to the person, you know? They're helpful to the person because the person is doing things which are harmful to others.
Uh-huh.
And therefore not, and therefore to yourself, because you have to integrate with other people, and the punishments are just showing the person, this is what it feels like to do the kind of thing that you did.
Trying to evoke empathy, so
that you can get empathy so that you don't do this kind of behavior again, because it's not good for you. It's just like parenting, you know, when parenting, I'm a bit of a weak dad, you know. That was one of my flaws, is I'm a weak dad. I don't like to punish. Yeah. I don't even like to enforce rules. I like people to like figure out the right thing to do on their own. So, you know, but that is a weakness. I admit that that's a weakness of dad, especially, should have some kind of, I don't know, strictness, right? There's rules for the sake of the child. And you have to correct the kids too. You can't just say, oh, everything is good. You know, I love you, so anything you do is good. I love you, so I'm going to say, you know, don't do that. Yeah. That's not helpful to you.
I mean, I totally agree with the idea of the need to evoke empathy and a sense of responsibility. So we grow, and in my opinion, we grow into the ultimate responsibility, which is love. I will say divine love is entails the ultimate responsibility. Yet, and we may agree to disagree here, but for me, I have a few sections here. It's a little bit disproportionate.
There's a couple.
One wolf without sharing will be devoured by worms for 100,000 years.
I love that.
Or one who robs others without dire necessity has their skin torn apart by red hot iron balls. And it's like a little gore. And not gore like Gore Lila, but gore.
Yeah, gore. Gore.
But I can understand. I read it as a more like a type of rhetorical device to invoke. I'm not saying there's no realm whatsoever. I'm not denying the totality of the existence of those realms, but I can understand, in my opinion, again, it's my reading, there is a little bit of spice there to invoke the necessary awareness of don't do that. But again, we may agree to disagree on this one. It's totally fine.
No, I don't feel like I disagree with that. I think it's true. But that, I think that the realm itself is metaphorical or dreamlike or mental. Mm-hmm. And that's why these wild things can't even happen there.
Yeah.
How are you supposed to get thrown off a cliff and then brought back up to the top and thrown off again? How is this supposed to happen? Mm-hmm. Because you don't have a physical body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not really happening.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part about fifth canto, to be honest, is all the universal structure stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part that slowed me down and kept me for like 2 years working on it.
Really?
Yeah. And there's still one chapter.
I won't publicly ask you if you believe that the earth is flat or not. I don't want to put you into trouble.
No. Well, it all depends on your perspective, you know?
Yeah. That's how I think.
If you're an ant, then the
flat at some parts and round at another parts.
Well, I mean, if you're small enough, then a round thing becomes flat.
Yeah.
And that's how it is for us. And if you just want to talk about practical things, then the ground is flat. But if you want to talk about the earth as a thing that's out in space and in relationship to the sun, then they're called globes. They're golak.
Yeah.
They're globes.
And on top of that, Sukadev Goswami is speaking about that. And how do we know from which place he's speaking internally, right? What is he seeing and experiencing that come in certain words and makes him express certain realities in certain literally form or shape. But
there's the opening chapter of the astronomy stuff is incredibly great, and it matches exactly to modern geography. He describes all the latitudes, everything, the circularity, the globeness of the world. It's incredible. So I got really excited when I had translated that chapter, because I thought the whole rest of it was going to be as easily translatable to modern science. But the rest of it goes into more of astrology, really.
Mm-hmm.
What it really is talking about is more of the ecliptic, the solstices, the equinoxes, and the symbolism, the places, the 12 different parks, the 12 different divisions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, actually, knowing astrology, knowing the astronomy that's involved in astrology, it let me be able to see what he's really talking about.
That took you 3 years. And if someone would not have been as informed as you are in astrology, it would have taken them less time, because they may have gone through that in a more simplistic way, right?
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Anyhow, you wrote a few other books, and I like to concentrate on one in particular, because among the books you've written and that I had the chance to read so far, the most recent one that I've encountered was your autobiography. I have it here, just in case. Train Wrecks and Transcendence, a Collision of Hardcore and Hare Krishna. I read it some months ago. I was in New Zealand, and I saw it I always see a bookshelf, and I go bumblebee-like there. I saw that one.
Yeah.
I saw that one last year, and I told the book, see you next year. and I really found it was very interesting. It was page turner for me, at least. Found many parallels in your journey as mine, not to sound too self-referential and then self-reverential. But yeah, we joined at the similar age. We came from a similar punk, hardcore, teenage background, playing in bands. Then we became deeply committed to our spiritual call, very totally fascinated with philosophy and deeply studying it, and yet gradually maybe becoming disenchanted with some institutional or hierarchical models, then going through some necessary crisis and so on. So there are many topics, of course, in in this book, because, of course, it's your life story. at least till the point you get married. So I'm sure many are waiting for part two and what comes after that. So I like to spend the rest of the conversation exploring some of the themes in you write about in your memoir. So, well, first of all, I really appreciate, how to say it, the sarcastic honesty of your disclosure while telling your story. You have a good sense of humor also. Maybe Thank Italian you. DNA also adds to the equation. But I appreciate how how you're naturally willing to embarrass yourself while describing many times how you will be sure and certain about some things and how eventually life will humble you and make you realize, well, life is bigger and deeper and more nuanced than you previously thought, which for me sounds like the Odyssey from Canista to Madhyam, right? And to me, for me, this same sounds like a life theme, how each of us can actually, ideally, hopefully, mature from an initial sense of toxic certainty. I know it all, I've conquered it all, I've colonized it all, to being more and more comfortable with mystery, with not knowing everything, with the grace between black and white, with reality being, I don't know, too vast and too deep to fully comprehend, yet at the same time undeniably beautiful. So I don't know if so far you agree with my reading of this pattern that I found in your narrative, and if so, I don't know how you see that shift shaping one's spiritual growth from initial certainty to being more nuanced.
Yeah, I like the way you read it. That is also just the basic pattern, right? According to Vishwanath Chakravarti and Madhurya Kadambini, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic pattern. You get Utsa and Mai, and then you get Ganatarala. So I guess it just happens to everybody. You get really excited. You get that really toxic certainty. And then you realize that you're not going to go back to Godhead, so to speak, in 4 weeks. And then you wonder about maybe it'll be 4 years. And then, you know, four years later, you're a little bit. Yeah, then you're a little bit faced with that dilemma of how much work do you actually want to put into this? But that's actually the fun part, really, is it's kind of like self-discovery, isn't it? Like, I kind of feel like I'm pulling away more and more layers of myself or of layers of my mind or something, so that it's just kind of seeing more and more how lazy I am, and then I don't want to work for this. But then you wind up thinking, no, that, you know, this ideal of Krishna, it's really beautiful. It's really worth it. Let's not give up. You know, let's hang on to whatever bit of it we can hang on to. And that's kind of the fun part, seeing how I survive. It's almost like a video game, like you have to get through some kind of maze or something and survive the bombs. And you see how you get through them and you get out the other side. It's kind of exciting. Yeah. And then sometimes you don't. You get bombed and you sink into the depths for a while. That's also exciting. I mean, I don't know. There's two ways to look at life. One is that it's hell and one is that it's beautiful. So I think maybe, you know, it's just more healthier to look at it like it's beautiful, even the bombs.
Yeah, I always like to think, and not to be a tragedy denier or that there is suffering or stuff that is happening, but not to zoom in into the hell part so much that we lose sight of the beautiful, and not to zoom in into beauty in the way that you become like a harmony junkie and everything is la la la, but how to integrate the tragic into the beautiful. But thank you for that, because I think we need more and more like memoirs and life testimonies of not just only superhero, transcendental, always pure sadhakas, but people who go through the messiness that we all go, so that people can really say, oh, that's relatable. That I see myself there. Like as you pointed, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is acknowledging this sixth expression of anishtita bhajana kriya, unstable bhakti. And for me, that's a way of validating those who are through that. Not to say stay there forever, that's the goal, welcome, congratulations, but to say, that will happen, and it's part of the journey. So the fact that you are going through all these embarrassing ups and downs, it's a confirmation that you are on the bhakti path. So in one sense, it's glorious. In one sense, it's a reason to celebrate. Oh, this is confirming that I'm on the path.
Yeah,
though I'm not supposed to stay here.
Yeah, I was thinking that when you were talking too.
Yeah. So reading your book is kind of that, right? Without it, maybe that framing, but just seeing a life journey that in going through all the weathers of the heart and the different landscapes, but normalizing. Yeah, this is part of the journey. Welcome. Be realistic. So thank you.
I feel like one thing about me is I'm kind of like a devotee of truthfulness. Like I like truthfulness.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't really ever see the value of like pretending that something isn't what it is or like hiding. I mean, I'm sure that right now I'm hiding tons of things from people, but not by my choice, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why when I wrote the memoir, I didn't really think like, oh, let's hide this or let's hide that. Or I didn't think like, is this going to be beneficial to talk about to people? Because if it's true, then it's beneficial. That's my feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's for me, like, Satyam Param Dhimahi, ultimately. Okay, wait, right, let's meditate on the supreme truth, but we can jump to Krishna and Braja Lila. No, but truthfulness. Let's begin with the foundation of being honest. That's how I like to think of Bhagavad Gita 9:30, Apichet Sudaracharo, Krishna saying, okay, even if you are a Duracharya, right, someone who behaves in a very bad way, but you are honest about it, Sadhu Reva Samantavya, for me, you are a sadhu. Like, for me, sadhu is also like an honest person. No matter where you are, be honest, and that in itself, as you say, will be touching and powerful. Yeah. So big part of the memoir, Braj Kishore, revolves around, of course, your loving affair with Krishna, but your loving affair with music as well. You being part of bands like 108, Shelter, but before any of this, a band called Inside Out, right? I never heard about that before reading your memoir. And in that band, Zach de la Rocha, singer of Rage Against the Machine, was the singer. I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Right. I never heard about Inside Out during my teenage years. I certainly knew and loved Rage Against the Machine. Again, I was a drummer, I was a guitar player, and I listened lots of music, but that type of music was also part of my music. So connected to my previous question regarding you having a more, you and not only you, of course, all of us having a more rigid stance in the beginning and gradually realizing, okay, reality is more spacious and calls for more compassionate understanding of situations and people. I remember a section of the book where Zach goes with you to a temple and he's attracted to some degree and you're asking him, well, what do you think? And he said, yeah, but I'm not so much into religious institutions. And I can definitely relate to that, and probably you as well. And gradually, of course, that and other things create some distance from both of you. And I like to read, if you allow me, a few lines.
Sure.
So also people can get an idea and a feel of the tone of your writing and reflecting back on those times to the point of necessary self-sarcasm. So Zach tells you, you've changed so much, man, Zach told me confidentially. We used to hang out and joke around and laugh, but now you are so serious all the time. You never hang out with us. It's like you've become a totally different person than the guy you were when we started this tour. And you say, in my diary, I'd explained to myself that Zach's dissatisfaction wasn't my fault. It was his. He was just too shallow. His idea of friendship, I told myself, was evaluated simply only on the basis of how much you can waste on one another's time laughing over meaningless things. I was proud of being incredibly serious about my life. I was not as interested in having good friends as I was in being incredibly serious and having all the answers to all the big questions.
Yeah.
So again, you have a good sense of humor.
it's not a sense of humor, it's just the truth.
But again, you put it on a smile to speak about tragedy. Sometimes we need to, we laugh not to cry. So eventually, of course, your commitment to exclusive Krishna Bhakti in the Utsahamayi chapter makes you live probably Inside Out. And there is a moving scene, I remember, where Zach ends up crying because of this separation and the friendship you both had. And then after some years, it comes in your memory that you meet with Zach again, and he was already in Rage Against the Machine, and you mentioned how he was reading Carlos Castaneda, and he was asking you whether you had any mystical visions or not through your practice, and you mentioned something like, not only was Zach's band 96 million times more powerful than mine, but now my spirituality was about to seem equally important next to his new literary expeditions with this Don Juan Carlos Castaneda guy, which, by the way, I read it in my teenage years and I loved it. So anyhow, looking back, how do you understand this whole arc today? The tension between spiritual commitment and friendship, the pain of separation, and later even a kind of self-reflecting humor when you encounter Zach's own evolving path. I don't know. Do you see it as a necessary exclusivity at the time or as something that might have unfolded differently with the more spacious understanding that you have developed after that?
Yeah, it should have unfolded differently. But, you know, like going back to the original thing that we were talking about with astrology, I really believe it couldn't have happened differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless, you know, I go back in time so far. You know, if I just go back to my teenage life, I don't think I would be able to make any other decisions than the ones that I went. Yeah. I probably have to go back like 15 lifetimes to be able to change what happened in this life. So, but the thing is, the thing that really pains me is after growing up, you know, after spending however many years I did with Bhagavad Gita and then growing up and finally sort of starting to understand it, it just seems so obvious that you're not supposed to displace a person from their dharmas. You know, like that's the whole thrust of not only Bhagavad Gita, but all over the Mahabharata.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thrust is like, you don't need to change. You don't, you have to not fight this war, Arjuna. You have to fight it in divine consciousness. So like thinking like that's such the basic message is that people don't need to radically change their life. They need to radically change their minds. I don't really understand why the Hare Krishnas were pushing kids to radically change their lives. You know, and I feel, I know victim mentality is not healthy, but I feel like I was a victim of that. You know, I was radically pushed to like become this radical guy who was like completely over serious and completely over dedicated. Of course, I'm susceptible to it. Of course, I'm the perfect candidate for that. But yeah, that's the thing when I look back on it, like I wish that was different. I wish my advisors had understood Krishna consciousness slightly so that they would have been able to.
They went for the same thing. They received the same advice somehow that you received or something like that.
I'm sure. Like I said, to change it, you would have to go back so far down the loop. So I think there's no way to change anything, and it's better to just kind of appreciate what happened and be thankful for the good that came out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to complain? I'm not going to complain about getting introduced to the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and getting, you know, introduced to all these things. However way I got, you know, even if I had to get dragged through hell, which I didn't, to do it, it would still be worth it. So it's not like I'm complaining, but I'm just, we're just talking about this topic.
And again, you are not the only one who may say things like the ones you say. I've talked to many who will express themselves in the same way. Not again, regretting, wanting to change the past, playing the victim, blaming the environment, but at least appreciate, okay, let's try to do things differently now, and let's try not to, as you say, not create a mismatch or like dysfunctional separateness and fracture between, okay, I have to leave everything behind and be a completely different person from whom I was last week. I remember reading a book by Purnachandra Swami, Unspoken Obstacles on the Path to Bhakti. That's a very interesting one. And he will, as a Prabhupada disciple, say, when we joined, I don't think there is in the history of humanity any movement that created such a sudden change in embracing a new culture and a new philosophy like we did in the 60s and 70s. From one day to the other, we changed our clothes, our food, our way of thinking, our way of everything. Just basically from a weekend to the next. And of course, in time, it was clear that we haven't integrated much of it. So, as you say, going back to the basics and say that, be who you are, as simple as that sounds. Learn to acknowledge your swabhav, where you are as a human. And in the name of being transcendental, do not become inhuman in the process, right? And have you stayed, I'm curious, have you stayed in touch with Zach after all this journey or ever felt inclined to reconnect with him, especially as, again, your perspective evolved over time regarding how you viewed people outside of your spiritual circle?
Unfortunately, I'm not too much in contact with him. And also, the way his life went, probably maybe isn't all like a bed of roses, as we would think, you know? Becoming famous is not really that great. Mm. It's a pain. And then you have to kind of isolate yourself and insulate yourself. And then also you sort of feel like people are always using you for what you have. So it kind of interferes with reconnecting. And I don't know. And plus, it doesn't help. Like, I'm not really very connected with any of my friends. This is one of the curses that I'm bearing in this lifetime, is that I have very poor relationships. Like, you know, I move because of all this moving into different countries and into temples and everything. I just broke all the relationships with all the friends, even though it's not like they're not my friends. It's just that they are on the other side of the world. I never see them. So same thing with Zach. Like, no, I don't really see him or talk to him, but it's not like we don't like each other.
Mm. Yeah. For those who do not know, actually, of course, you lived in Japan now for some years already, but you've been born in the US, but been all around also. Another dynamic that comes in your memoir, Braj Kishore, is, of course, that appears throughout. It's your relationship with your parents. And you mentioned how they were very loving and very supportive. And there seems to have been a period that, again, your way of relating to them reflected a more rigid and absolutistic expression of your spiritual commitment. That many, again, the way many Gaudiyas will do so, which is quite in a cultish way. But over time, the relationship appears to have softened and returned to a more natural human connection. And you mentioned, I assume that's also describing your dad's own memoir that he wrote that referred you to the book, like Krishna's Punk, A Parent's Journey. I look forward to reading that one. So, and you now are a father of three. So how has your own experience of parenthood influenced the way you relate to your own parents today?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I got my karma in some ways from the way I treated my parents, the things that I have to deal with now as a parent. But I really felt like that was one of the happiest and best things that happened to me was to become a dad. Mm-hmm. And also the most beneficial to my evolution as a human being. One of the most, honestly, you know. As much as sadhana is supposed to be powerful, I think I hardly do it correctly enough for it to be powerful. The thing that was really powerful for me was becoming a dad.
Which is its own kind of sadhana, right?
Yeah, or it's dharma or something. It's like I have to be so responsible all of a sudden. Even to this day, like I still have to make money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so amazing for a person like me to have to deal with that responsibility of making money and paying bills so that people actually survive and don't go into crisis. It's a lot of responsibility to carry, but it's really good. You know, it really reformed a lot of the like radical aspects of my personality, unruly aspects of my personality, or overly independent aspects of my personality got a lot reformed by parenthood, even more so than marriage. The parenthood was really a really beautiful thing. My kids are fantastic, but they all have their problems, you know? They will have their problems.
Like any truly fantastic person.
But that's also part of the responsibility is to help your children.
Yeah.
You know, so it's nice. It's an ongoing thing. It's not like, but they're all grown up now. The youngest one is 14. So pretty much they're all out of that super young age where you really have to be there for them all the time.
Do they live in Japan, the three of them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. I always ask devotees who have children to share their testimony of epiphany at becoming a parent, a mother, a father, because I know and I've always heard how transforming that is. And I always think, okay, I'm a sannyasi, so I don't have biological children, but so I better get responsible with the people under my care, my children, because if not monastic, life can be just escapism and spiritual bypassing.
Yeah, I like that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And of course, we are also speaking, we talked about Zach, a friend, your parents. We are speaking about healing relationships. And nowadays, at least in part of the Gaudiya community, there is a lot of conversation regarding women and their role and contribution, whether they can be Diksha gurus or not, and other related topics. So you've written some articles in the past on your website, but also in your bio, you refer to a fanzine, if I may call it that way, the Inquirer that you will publish at the time. I also published my fanzines in my teenage years. And you shared some interesting one issue that you published. You share interesting compilations of quotes of Prabhupada just regarding the position of woman. Let me share just two. From a purport of Bhagavatam 3.14.17, the wife is considered to be the source of all liberation. Therefore, husbands as a class cannot repair the debt to woman, either in this life or in the next. And another one from Bhagavatam 4.25.21, for those who do not believe me, women, on the other hand, are to be seen as embodiments of divinity and representatives of intelligence. So beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. Do you think the tension around women in some parts of the tradition, I don't know, points to something deeper that maybe we have learned to, as Gaudiyas, to revere the sacred feminine, Jai Shri Radhe, in theology, but still struggle to embody that honoring the feminine in practice in our own feminine dimension? If so, what will it take to close the gap? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I'm very, very pro-feminine, so probably not unbiased. But one thing I do think should be said is that most of the issues that you're bringing up aren't really related to the Gaudiya tradition. It's just this one little bubble of it.
Yeah. That's why I try to clarify some section of the Gaudiya community.
Yeah, some section of it. Like,
I don't want to make it sound like this is our philosophy. This is how the essence of our everyone believes in the tradition. Yeah. Thank you for emphasizing this.
It's just maybe the ISKCON and then the spinoffs of the related things related with that. They got these odd ideas. They're really odd ideas, really. You know, it's kind of almost as odd as, like, how is it that Bhagavad Gita is so obviously pro-karma yoga, but yet I was advised to go for renunciation? It's similarly like, how is it that the Vedas are obviously so either egalitarian or actually pro-feminine, but yet there's this misogyny going on there? How is that happen? How is it? Well, are you people reading these things? Are you reading these books? Which parts are you reading?
Which filters are you having in front of you while reading the books?
Yeah. I mean, the issue of women Diksha gurus is like, why don't you just look at the lineages? Why don't you just look in the history books of the lineages, and then you could stop asking that question. You could have stopped asking that question 45 years ago, the day after you asked it.
Yeah. For me, the fact that the question is there points to a problem. The fact that you're questioning that, it speaks, that's the tip of the iceberg. What's the actual problem behind that?
It points to a reluctance to accept an answer.
Yeah.
Anyway, things are what they are. best thing I ever did for myself was just worry about myself more, not the other people and the other people's problems and everything. I have enough problems. I have to worry about those.
Yeah. Speaking about responsibility, right? It's so easy to spend too much time in how the world or other people are living their lives. And we have so many good reasons to be, quote unquote, many good reasons to be attentive to that and totally dismiss doing our homework. So thank you. Let me read one last section from your memoir, if you allow me with you.
Oh, can I say one thing?
Yeah, of course.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
That fanzine, The Inquirer, there's a publisher somewhere in some Nordic country who's gotten all those zines together. And he's going to publish it as a book with some new material added in. And I think that might happen this year.
Okay.
That'll be exciting.
Yeah. And your fifth canto volume will be published this year as well.
And Yoga Sutras
as well, all this year.
Hopefully, if the samskaras allow the karma to fructify. Yeah.
Speaking of,
it's a rough time right now. Yeah, it's a rough time.
Okay. But
hopefully that will happen.
So one last section I like to read from your book. When you point to something I consider very important in relation, of course, to the topic of women, but also beyond that one especially, and it's more related to how we interpret what a guru says. Most of us may sometimes interpret what a guru says based on our capacity to draw from that person, though we often, again, make our filters the totality of that person. So it says, then I thought of Prabhupada. He was so different during the very early years of ISKCON, when his circumference was so much smaller and women were also an important part of it. Later, the circumference became so different and he too seemed very different. I began to realize that what ISKCON was accepted as Prabhupada's mood was really only the mood of Prabhupada's circumference at a given point in time. Even what they saw as Prabhupada's teachings was only the teaching they had managed to evoke from him. And what they propagated was only what they had managed to comprehend of the teachings they had evoked. So I really appreciate especially everything but the last para sentence. So based on what I just read, I'm curious how you navigated over time this tendency to filter and project and limit the other to what we think the other to be or what we need the other to be for us at any given moment, rather than being open to who the other actually is. Being open to being transformed by who the other actually is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a hard thing. For me, what I really like is source material, you know? Uh-huh. And I think the reason why I like source material as much as possible because I feel that cuts out filters and it cuts out middlemen, you know? It's supposed to be a transparent via media, but maybe it's not quite always transparent, you know, the way that we're receiving the information from Shastra, especially if Shastra is right in front of your face, why not just pick it up and read it? And so I really like, that's why I do the work that I do with the Bhagavatam, because I really enjoy that. I really feel connected when I just go and read as well as I can from the original language itself and go from there, you know? And then when things don't make sense or, you know, of course I check it with guru, I check it, you know, I make sure I'm not going in the left field or something. Mm-hmm. Of course you need that kind of guidance as well, but I feel like source material, going to the source, going to the Bhagavatam for us, for the Gaudiyas, it's the Bhagavatam really, you know, going to the Bhagavatam as much as possible, as cleanly as possible, as directly as possible, with as much of an open mind as possible, you know? Thing I really enjoy about the Bhagavatam is when I read it, I realize it could be, you know, it just feels real. It just feels like they're talking about real things that are really meaningful and that it could actually happen. You know, these are the things that actually happen. It's not fanciful stories. Anyway, so yeah, I think that one of the way to get out of, to solve that problem of like the filtering and the circumference surrounding a person, I just had a nice thought, but one of the ways of getting out of that circumference is to just go directly to the source material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The thought that I had a nice thought too. I just remember that there's a poem, I think it's Bilva Mangal Thakur, which is talking about Krishna's circumference, mm-hmm. which is, he's surrounded by he's eclipsed by gopis.
Mm.
And so it's just, if your via media is so beautiful, then then it works like Shuka, amplifying Vyasadeva's message and creating the Bhagavatam. It actually enhances the beauty of the thing. It's like a magnifying glass or something. Uh-huh. So to access Krishna through his circumference is even more beautiful than accessing him directly. But when you're feeling that there's some kind of problem or something with your access, then, well, you can go straight to it. Go straight to it as much as possible. Uh-huh. That's what helped me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And since you mentioned, the ideal role of guru, transparent, be a medium, and sometimes feeling there's not enough transparency or total transparency or whatever, and they need to go to source material on how to navigate those moments. Again, we have talked about different topics so far: astrology, music, you as an author, your relationship with friends, parents, thoughts of the feminine. So let's maybe conclude here addressing one of those important connections, which is Guru, we just briefly touched upon, and also the figure of Guru and some potential, again, difficulties that one could have in relationship to those figures, at least in some cases. I have mine. Though, again, you haven't talked about this in detail in your memoirs, since the dynamics mostly happen, this dynamics with some complexity, if I understood correctly, happened after you got married. But you eventually went through some, let's say, unexpected dynamics with who at the time was your main spiritual reference, which, again, I can relate to based on my own experience. And though I'm not aware of where you stand today internally, and this can be, again, very personal, private affair, but anyhow, I like to ask you, what's your current, and you say something already, what's your current understanding on Guru, of Guru Tattva? How you see your journey evolving in how you originally conceived the role of the Guru, on how, if this happened, how that changed over time?
Mm-hmm. For me, it's very similar to that thing that we talked about before, about how I really like things that are simple. And I think really Guru Tattva is really such a simple thing. It's the person that teaches you about a subject. It's the person who gives you access to a subject. So in other words, it's the person who's carrying the subject to you. So, I mean, that's simple. And whether or not a person is my guru isn't really, there's no questions to it. It's whether or not I'm receiving access to the subject through the person or not. If you're teaching me stuff that I'm actually learning about tennis, then you're my tennis guru. You don't have to initiate me. You don't have to accept me. I don't have to accept you. It's just a fact. It's just a functional fact that you're my guru for that subject. And I got attracted. And that's what attracted me to Prabhupada in the first place, to be honest with you. Because one of the first things that I read from Prabhupada was Ishopanishad. And in the introduction to Ishopanishad, it's like a transcription of a class that he gave somewhere in Britain somewhere or something. Yeah. And kind of, he said, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to talk about the Vedas. And the Vedas are the actual source of authority for knowledge. And that's where we get our knowledge from. And you're considered, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course, you're considered right or wrong based on how much you have fidelity to the Vedas. And I thought, that's mind-blowing. That makes sense. And that became a truth for me. And luckily for me, that is a Vedic truth. That is the way the Vedantic schools feel about things. So it's not like a guru can just make up stuff or just come up with new ideas. The guru is just the person that is showing you what the Shastra is and helping you really understand the Shastra. Mm-hmm. That's what a guru is. If it's Shastra, you know, if you want to learn tennis, then the guru is the person who understands tennis and is showing you what tennis is. So, yeah, I got attracted to gurus who also had the same idea about what a guru is. You know, the responsibility of a guru is to teach you Krishna's words, to teach you Krishna's teachings directly. Here it is. It's in the Shastra. Now understand the Shastra. So I like that. And I feel confident about that too. Mm-hmm. You know, because you don't always worry, like, what if my guru falls down, or what if my guru isn't really a guru? You don't have that problem anymore. If the guru is the access to the Shastra, you know, you're getting the Shastra through the guru, it doesn't really matter if the guru eats onions or garlic. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it doesn't really matter. It just matters if you are understanding and getting access to Krishna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you see your own role as guru? Because you may not be given diksha, but I'm sure people look up to you as a teacher. You write books, you write articles. So
people do. I have to pity them a bit for that. I pity them a bit for that. Mm-hmm. But then again, no, I'm glad to be able to have that responsibility.
Yeah.
Because also it's, I'm the kind of person that the only way that I learn is by explaining something.
Mm.
And even when I'm sitting there by myself studying something, in my head, I have like a couple of people in my head that I'm explaining the subject to.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's, to me, it's very helpful to have a student or have somebody asking me questions. It's like, that's actually more like their service. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, it's more like they're my teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, you could get a big head about being in a guru role if you think that the guru means that you're this perfect person and everything.
Mm.
But if you think that the guru is, you know, yeah, of course I'm a guru. If I understand how to make tea, then I can become a tea guru. What's the big deal? There's nothing egotistical about it. It's not a big ego trip. I just know how to make tea. And the beautiful thing is the tea.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, how gloriously I'm teaching you how to make tea. It's the taste of the tea. Enjoy the tea.
Facilitating a certain type of content and experience.
Sometimes there's people who are very into like a personality cult or something. Oh, you know, you can sense that right away.
Yeah.
You're my guru. You're my guru. I don't want to hear I'm your guru. I'm your guru. If I'm your guru, then I'll just listen to the stuff that I'm saying. And you shouldn't even be talking about you're my guru. I'm not your guru. You are my guru. Let's just talk about the subject.
Yeah. We should be too concerned with the subject to have time to say, you are my guru. You are my guru. Both guru and disciple are too concerned about going deep into the actual thing, so to say, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So, Braj Kishore, after all these chapters, music, devotion, doubts, relationships, astrology, software developing, we didn't touch that one today, but anyhow, some other day, authorship and everything in between, where does Braj Kishore find himself standing today? Not in terms of roles, but in terms of how, I don't know, how you understand yourself, your path, life, your relationship with the divine at this particular moment of your journey.
It's still not very clear to me. I still don't really understand myself very well. Still a lot of pains, a lot of difficult emotional things dealing with, a lot of difficult personality traits that I don't want to have.
Hmm.
But, you know, there's like nice things. There's a lot of challenges to go through, but there's a lot of nice things too, nice experiences. My friend just sent me a message. There's people that want to do things with me. There's people that want to interact with me. I'm grateful for that. Yeah, where do I stand? I don't know. I never really think that much in advance. I'm just trying to, I guess you could say, since we are who we are right now talking, I guess you could say I'm just trying to be Krishna conscious right now. Uh-huh. But I wouldn't really say that the same way to somebody else. But, you know, I'm just trying to appreciate the beauty of Krishna that's all that is here, that's around me, and the fact that I'm alive and the ability to breathe and exist and be aware of things. I'm trying to appreciate that. And I'm just hopeful that I can keep on like working with the Bhagavatam, keep on studying the things, stay healthy. Hopefully I can stay healthy.
Mm. I don't know. Yeah. Thank you. I know. An honest answer, that's all we need. So thank you for your honesty. So you plan to, I can assume, I hope you are planning to go through all the volumes of the Bhagavatam, right?
I really want to, but the fifth canto really slowed me down.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you reach 10th canto, we may got you lost and found in the ocean of the 10th canto. Who knows?
I hope so.
Yeah.
One of my reasons for really taking the time with the first 9 cantos is like, I want to really get the 10th canto. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to just pay lip service to it. I really want to get it. So I feel like it's worth it.
Yeah. Thank you. Anything else? Any final thoughts you'd like to share with us before we put our sharing to rest today?
Just that I'm very grateful. This was a really enjoyable conversation. Thank you so much for having it.
Okay. It's mutual. Thank you so much, Raj Kishore, for coming.
Thank you.